Do you want to talk about books?
Yeah.
Hello, and welcome to A Well-Read Life. This is a place to share stories about good books and the reading life. I'm your host, Beth Jamison. Join me as I meander through my reading journey and discover the books that make up a well-read life.
Welcome back. In the last episode, I mentioned that I was just about to have an interview with someone I was very excited to share with y'all. Well, today I have the interview with Brittany Kunin talking about fairy tales. Brittany shares a love of children's literature and fairy tales with me. And when I found that out, I knew I had to have her on the show. During our conversation, I just had the most delightful time, and I learned so much from her. I can't wait to share it with you. But before I do, just a little bit about Brittany. Brittany Kunin is a wife, mother of three, and professor of English in a small South Carolina university where she teaches courses on children's literature and fairy tales. Her background includes degrees in English literature with an emphasis in children's literature, and she also blogs about books at Tales of a Bookworm. Most of all, though, she loves reading books, especially with her own children. Just from that description alone, you can tell she is a woman after my own heart. And I hope that you enjoy this conversation as much as I did. Brittany, welcome to the show. I want to start out with just a very short question of what is it that attracts you to fairy tales?
So what I have, I think, discovered and rediscovered about fairy tales is, as an adult, this kind of paradox of something that is on the surface simple, quote unquote, but really layers in morals and history and culture. And so as an adult, I can appreciate those layers. Not that children can't, because of course they can if you teach it to them, but because as an adult, I now see those layers in multiple ways. And so I think that's one of the things that I really love about them. I've loved also just researching and teaching and reading because of their age. I don't know why I'm attracted to something that's been around for so long. It almost to me feels like we get to, in a way, transcend time when we read and like share these stories. So there's kind of multiple reasons as an adult I have kind of taken these up as something, as a, you know, pet project or a passion, if you will.
So is it more of just you have researched them on your own time, or have you used them in any of your coursework or any research that you've done?
So kind of both. I definitely read them as a child. I don't know that I was as immersed in them as maybe some people were, or even like generations before were. And my children, I've read them several, you know, Hansel and Gretel being one of their favorites that I scared the pants off them with. But it's definitely something. My background is in children's literature. And I noticed at, you know, when I was going through and thinking about some literature classes I was teaching, that there didn't seem to be a ton out there. And I'm not saying that there aren't experts. I have a few that I'm going to reference tonight. There are definitely people who have dedicated their lives to this. But it didn't feel to me, especially, you know, years ago, that this was something that was brought up. You didn't hear about it on podcasts or, you know, blogs or things like that. So, you know, I think that's kind of what interests me. It was kind of like digging into something that I didn't know too much about. And then now I get to teach it and talk about it, which is great fun for me.
Oh, I know. You mentioned the Hansel and Gretel. So I have read Hansel and Gretel to my little girl. And I think it's so funny. We grew up with these stories. A certain age, you just grow up with them and they become part of your makeup. But then as an adult, you read it and you're like, wow, that's really dark. So much darker than I realized. And it's... But it's at the same time, it's like, I don't want to shelter my little girl from these stories that are so much a part of our culture and make up so much of our cultural language. And just like you mentioned, the morals that are in there. And so I kind of try to navigate that with her, but I'm enjoying it. And I'm surprised at a lot of times she is more resilient than I'm expecting her to be with the story. So that's been a little bit more of me, like, I don't know, trying to, as a parent, navigate those waters. But I, like I said, I love
absolutely
them, and I'm all for them being read to children. I think it's so important. And
absolutely,
my little girl isn't as sensitive as I think some children. It might be a little bit much with the Hansel and Gretel,
right,
and she just is not as afraid as I was.
Yeah.
Brittany, you mentioned in one of our early emails how and to whom we credit the authorship of fairy tales. This has really piqued my interest since your email, and I'd love to discuss this with you in more depth. I just am so curious of your research.
Right. So I guess without getting too far in the weeds, I would agree with you. Yes. I would say that the Anderson and the Grimms and the Charles Perrault, most people are familiar with them because there are literary fairy tales. So the distinction being that the literary fairy tales were written and published and shared by these authors and other authors as well. And I call them authors. I'll get into that in a second. I mean, I think it's just easier for the sake of that because it is their publication. But what we know is there's kind of this vast trove of oral storytelling, as kind of far back as we can tell, or as we know, were shared by mouth, by teller, by culture. And so we kind of consider these literary fairy tales written versions of the oral fairy tales, or what we often call peasant fairy tales. And that gets a little bit into history, the way the stories were shared and reshared. But I wouldn't say that these authors were the original in terms of plot or in terms of character. They certainly are and should be, I think, credited, but they are formed from hundreds of years of oral stories. And so it's kind of, where did, for example, Charles Perrault get his ideas from? Well, what we know is that he got those probably from his children's governesses or nannies, whatever term you want to call it, that are something that we're being told in, you know, by the fire to the children at night, right? And so where did the governesses get it from? Well, they might have gotten it from their family, and then those families might have gotten it there. So there's this kind of like snowball effect. If we're to believe, which I think we are, and actually the nannies, governesses, whatever term we want to use here, were some of the most prolific storytellers, and I believe it.
Yeah, definitely.
There's a whole host of interesting analysis of the role of the governess or the grandmother as the storyteller, but also who also makes a role in the story itself, right? Isn't it kind of funny that character is always in the story?
Yes.
And for example, like the Brothers Grimm, you know, they set out, well, they had kind of several purposes, but one of their recorded purposes that we know, they saw these stories as cultural artifacts. Mm-hmm. And so they wanted these to be recorded as to not be lost, right? If these are artifacts of our culture, they almost, in a sense, they were kind of archaeologists, I guess, in a way. Now, they did edit and revise and adapt a ton of stories. I mean, you could look at any, you know, volume that they have. But again, in a sense, like, did they originally come up with every single story? No, they took them, they molded them, they shaped them. And so one of the kind of analogies that we use in class in Maria Tatar. So she's one I'll probably reference a lot. Okay. So Maria Tatar is one of those critics who has done a ton of work with fairy tales. She has written essays and analyzed and published. I mean, she knows a lot about fairy tales. And one of the things that she talks about fairy tales is kind of, I guess, a better way to think about it is like a recipe of a stew. Right. So like, you know, when you have a stew, who's the first person who made a beef stew? Well, can we really pinpoint that? Can we really say like it was this person right here? Right. They probably got it from their family. And the analogy works, too, if you think about recipes in general. And I think that's a great way to think about fairy tales as a recipe. You know, if I say meatloaf, everybody's got their own family recipe and they put their own seasoning in it, and we get the same result, but we're all kind of putting in our own cultural, family, social changes to it. And so I think that's one of the better ways to think about fairy tales. That being said, I think that if you are talking about fairy tales, you got to be talking about the Brothers Grimm. You got to be talking about Hans Christian Andersen. They are the front runners, the foremost. You know, there's a reason we credit them. But there's a lot of history behind the stories that before the authors started putting them down on paper, if that makes sense. And I tried to condense that.
No, that's so interesting. I hadn't even thought about it. I thought about that for the Grimms, but I hadn't thought about that for Hans Christian Andersen. So that's so fascinating.
They certainly have their own. There's no question that those authors took these oral tales and Hans Christian Andersen and some, you know, if you start to broaden your, you know, your look at the authors, you know, he's definitely got his own original. Like he's a little bit later in time, so he might be taking stories and then adding in things. And Charles Perrault was, you know, this French aristocratic living in Paris writer. So his stories are obviously going to be different from the Brothers Grimm. But that's, to me, that's the nice thing about these quote unquote recipes, right? Like you're looking at it and you get a feel for the culture or the time frame, like, you know, when Hans Christian Andersen was writing, right? Like you get that, to me, you get that feeling, you get that atmosphere from it.
Absolutely. And I know that we had, this isn't the questions that I sent you. So I hope this is
okay. No, you're fine. You're fine.
That we had talked about Beauty and the Beast and how it was credited to women first. Is that correct? Mm-hmm.
That is correct. Okay. Yes.
Yeah. I have a copy of it and I cannot pronounce the name. I believe I sent it to you. I was thinking of getting it.
Oh, yes. That one. Yeah, that one. Yes. I remember that now. Yes.
I will put it in the show notes, but it's definitely my French is just deplorable.
Oh, please.
I have been reading it and I'm going to do it later on the podcast, but I'm so curious about this. I would love to hear more about, because we don't hear a lot of, even though the nannies and the governesses were some of the ones who had the first ingredients into fairy tales, we don't hear of a lot of female authors, writers of the fairy tales as much. Or correct me if I'm wrong on that one.
No, you're absolutely right. And what is funny, and there's a lot of good kind of literary criticism about this, because what we believe historically, like I wouldn't say all oral storytelling was done by females. You know, that would be a way too big broad generalization.
Yeah.
What we do know is when we get these hints through history that we did have grandmothers and females who were sitting around the fire and often nannies and governesses, and maybe aunts, who were the ones maybe telling it during times where maybe everyone was sitting by the fire and we were darning our socks or whatever, right? So there's a lot of interesting look at that role. Part of the reason I'm attracted to a lot of the fairy tales, now not all of them, because of course not all of them have a main female heroine or a main, you know, they have different characters, is because to me, a lot of them are female centered. And when you look at things like Snow White, Sleeping Beauty, Beauty and the Beast, Cinderella, you get a juxtaposition of evil women versus virtuous women. And to me, it's always been a fascinating, it's fascinating for discussion. I think it bothers a lot of my students that, you know, in many of those types of stories that the males are kind of almost off to the side, I guess, to use like a theater term, but it doesn't bother me. It interests me more, you know, and I'm a lot older than them and I have kids. So I'm like, so Beauty and the Beast, there's actually two women who are credited with it, but Jean-Marie Prince de Beaumont, so I just call her de Beaumont, was the one who we can look back. She wasn't far behind Charles Perrault. So Charles Perrault published Tales of Mother Goose, which was the title of his in 1796. I'm not going to do the French version because, again, I would butcher it. So what's interesting is Tales of Mother Goose is the title of his publication of stories. So we kind of in the modern era perceive Mother Goose as more of a rhyme title, or at least I did when I was growing up.
Definitely me too.
But for him, that title was to imply like a nursery, like for younger people. So it wasn't necessarily rhymes. It was something that would have been your nanny, your sister, you're in the nursery, you're a child. These are for that age group. generally. So anyway, she would have known the popularity of his story. But what's interesting about her is that she was married to a somewhat aristocratic, I guess, for lack of a better word, she had a titled marriage. She ended up leaving him. Again, these are all scant historical reports, so it's not super accurate. But we do know that she ended up not being married and decided to move away and become a nanny slash governess for a family and to teach young women of this particular family, and found herself really, I guess, enjoying it, liked it, and decided to go ahead and write this particular tale for them or for women like them. She is definitely, what we know is that she wanted that story to be a teaching tale. She wanted it to be something that women could learn from, if you will. So she definitely had didactic motivations, like this is something that will teach them something. Now, I don't know if it's coincidence that one of my favorites, because this was your next question, but it's Beauty and the Beast, but it just, I don't know. I don't know it's the fact that it became from a woman. I suspect it maybe, but it's one of my favorite fairy tales. And I love that I kind of enjoy the history of her, you know, knowing how she did it. And to me, the story is timeless. You know, I can't get around it. So her background is really interesting. Now, the Beauty and the Beast, there are categorizations of fairy tales. So we have these really, really smart people who went through and categorized fairy tales. So we could have just a catalog list of, okay, we have these types of tales and the child tale and the male child tale and the Cinderella type tale. So we have an official categorization. And the story, though, which always complicates because you're like, well, De Beaumont did this great version that is basically the one that we know today. But the concept of a female and the beast, so we call them like female beast story, we can find it in many, many cultures. So if you look at Russian fairy tales, or even if you go to South American fairy tales, you do find these stories where you have a woman who is virtuous and beautiful, oftentimes in an arranged marriage with some type of animal, right? So what we interpret from these stories is that they are stories to help young women, a cultural tale that we can find not just in French fairy tales, that we have this kind of woman and beast marriage situation. And so Cinderella also, we'll talk about that probably in a little bit, but Cinderella is also like that, where I guess point of what I'm trying to say is she definitely has, I would say, the version of Beauty and the Beast that we know, and it's one of my favorites, but it's certainly a cultural phenomenon as a tale to what we kind of think is to help women be reassured by the concept of marriage and marriage to maybe someone they don't know, or marriage just in general as like a frightening, overwhelming, what's going to happen right in this situation.
And so you're mentioning like the Beauty the Beast tales in other countries. And as you were saying that, I was thinking of the myth of Cupid and Psyche, which is a very similar story. I mean, I think it was like 2 years ago, maybe it was a year ago, we read Till We Have Faces in one of my book clubs. So I'm just thinking of how similar that is. And also, I don't know how close it is, but East of the Sun, West of the Moon.
Absolutely. Yeah, so. Yes. And to me, so like when I said the age of the story, that's where it starts to unravel, but unravel in a good way. You know, wait a minute. Oh, they did that too? Or they did this too? You know, and it's funny when you study the beasts across different cultures, like sometimes the beast is described as more of like a boar. Some are more lionish and some are like just frogs. And like Italian ones are pigs, which is a really funny read. Because throughout the, it's just like she married pig. And the other thing about fairy tales too, is that some of them are kind of raunchy, like not in like a 2024 HBO sense, but just kind of like, you know, allusions and things, as you mentioned, that may go over kids' heads now, but you know, as an adult, you're like, okay, I see now what happened there.
So I think of the Rapunzel story, because in some of the versions, she has the twins. And some versions say they said vows to each other, and other versions don't say anything about that. And I remember I grew up, of course, like with these fairy tales, and grew up with the story of Rapunzel. And I don't know if you ever saw this, but Shelley Duvall, I think, had a fairy tale theater. It was on the Disney Channel when I was growing up. And she did a version of Rapunzel, and she had that in there. And I remember the shock of being a child because I'd never heard of that version. So yeah, it's just, it's interesting.
I'll have to check that out. That's funny.
Yeah.
There's some really funny like 70s and 80s versions too. I was trying to think of one. There's like a Sleeping Beauty 70s musical and it's just so bizarre. It's totally 70s. You can find it on YouTube and I can't think of like
Slipper in the Rose.
It might be, but it's just like,
yes,
yeah.
I think I know which one you're talking about.
Your audience, my students never know this, but I grew up on it and it's like, this is my personality to a T, but it was an 80s TV show. Beauty was like a New York City reporter and Beast lived in the sewers.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Thank you. Thank you. And to everybody listening, if you know this, then you know. But like, I wish you could see my students when they look at me like, is that how it was back then? And I'm like, it was. And it was great. You know? I always think, I'm like, is that something that really influenced my love of Beauty and the Beast? Because man.
Hilarious.
Yeah. So there's adaptations. You could spend so much time talking about adaptations, good, bad, and just straight up cheesy. Yeah. You know,
I know I have a friend who we're kind of in the same kind of homeschool group. And she was talking about reading one of the fairy tale books she has to her daughter. And she was like, it's terrible. It's awful. Like the version of it is just awful. She's like, it gives the prince the name like Kyle and has like these names for people. And she's like, it's written so poorly, but her little girl loved it. And so she was just I think kept waiting for her to forget about that certain one because she did not enjoy reading it at all.
I feel that.
Yeah. So we've covered a little bit of your personal favorites. You said Beauty and the Beast is one, but I would love to hear of your other favorites. And I really want to know what it is about these particular stories that has so captured your imagination.
So Charles Perrault has a couple of versions of Cinderella, Little Glass Slipper, which by the title is basically the Disney version that we know. But he also published one called Donkey Skin, which is the same story, except for there's a few differences, like the glass slipper isn't in it and she has to kind of find the prince by escaping her father. That's one of my favorite ones because it's such a good riff. Like it's the same story, but it's not. And I really like sharing about it because there's a few like moments where the audience always is like, you know, but in the end it turns out. And I always like the ending of his stories, which I think we're going to talk about later. But then what I call kind of the clever children category. So like the Tom Thumb series. Now Tom Thumb, it's kind of confusing because there are stories that are Tom Thumb and then there are stories that are just like Tom Thumb, but also named Tom Thumb, but aren't quite. So I call them the Tom Thumb series, but these are the ones where it's typically a little boy. And one of my favorite ones is one from Charles Perrault. And it's the boy is like tiny. He's the size of a thumb. And he outwits kind of several people throughout the story because he gets like kind of separated from his parents. He kind of goes on these like crazy adventures. There's another variation of Tom Thumb I can give you these specific links if you want our titles.
Oh, I love that.
There's another one where we get like a Tom Thumb. Like it's always like that he's kind of the runt of the family. So he's like super small and super weak or whatever, perceived as weak, but always super clever, right? And I always love the ones where the clever kids like win in the end. So essentially in this series, they come across ogres. And ogres are vicious. I always say like if the ogres are in the story, you might want to think about your like how old your kids are kind of.
Okay.
Yeah. But what's great about this one though, even though there's some kind of brutal parts in it, he ends up saving his brothers from the ogres. And like, he has these kind of fantastical 7-league boots that help him like move quickly and move far and fast. So they're kind of super adventurous, super quick paced, but Molly Whoopi is one that is a female variation of this and maybe not as popular.
I've never heard of it.
Yeah. So Joseph Jacobs, if you look up like the blue fairy tale book, Joseph Jacobs did a ton of work and he's mostly considered like a curator collector, but he did a great job. This was like turn of the century, late early 20th century. So he curated a bunch of fairy tales and you can get the blue fairy tale book, the red fairy tale book. I highly recommend those because they're just like straight tales in there. So a lot of them are kind of more English, Scottish based because he was British, but Molly Whoopi is like a Scottish version of Tom Thumb and she outwits the ogre. I'm trying to remember if this one is as violent as the others. I don't think it is. There's usually some sort of some sort of action to defeat. I don't think she's as violent, but Molly Whoopi is just one of my favorites because she's just like, she's got three sisters. She's Molly Whoopi. She outwits, and it's quick and it's clever. So I would recommend that one too.
Okay. I have that. I just wrote that one down because I'm so excited about it. My husband and I are planning a trip to Scotland in the fall. So
I'm so jealous. That's going to be amazing.
We have been waiting to go on this trip. So hopefully nothing happens to derail it. It's twice we've had planned the trip and it's been derailed, but I am looking for any sort of Scottish story. So that is.
Well, I will have to send you some too, because there's a great Snow White version that is like a Scottish one. And I do not ask me to pronounce. I always butcher the name of it because it's like the Sergei, but I know I'm not even saying it right. So I'll have to send you some. Yeah, for sure. That's exciting.
I would love to hear that. Some of my favorites are The Snow Queen. I have talked about that before. I love that so much. And then recently, I love The Nightingale. I just did that episode. I was shocked at how much I love that story. And I don't even know if this would be really considered a fairy tale, but The Selfish Giant by Oscar Wilde.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
I love that story as well. Yes. But yes, Beauty and the Beast is a favorite. I really like Little Red Riding Hood. There's a version illustrated by Trina Shart Hyman. I love her illustrations. And my little girl went through this Little Red Riding Hood. She was such a big fan of that.
Yeah, that is a great one for kids too.
Right. Yeah. We read so many versions of it. Yeah. And then there was the one, it's one that won, I think, a Caldecott decades ago when I was a child, but Lawn Popo. Do you?
Yes.
But it was, I read it to her when she was really little. And so she was like, didn't register. But then I read it to her when she was a little bit older and there was some fear of that wolf was a little creepier.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Those are some of her favorites. So I'm enjoying like finding the ones that she loves. And also I read recently, I've mentioned to you in an email, I have started a little fairy tale play group. We don't always get to a fairy tale, but that's they're for my daughters. Yeah. For my daughter's friends. But the first one that we read was, I think it's called The Star Money or The Star Coins. Yeah. It's very, very short and it's a very sweet story. So
I'll have to look at it.
So I do want to know, you talked about it a little bit, but the Beauty and the Beast, what is it that you love the most about the story?
Well, as I've said, I always wondered, did the 80s sitcom influence me to like that story? And then I can't not admit the 90s cartoon movie version, I think like totally influenced an entire generation.
It's one of my favorites.
Yeah, me too. So like I grew up on that. You know, I've had people ask me before, I'm like, I don't think it's necessarily quote unquote bad. I just think like read them too. Like why not and both, you know?
Yeah.
So that was kind of one of those things that I think was just ingrained in my childhood, probably like many, many people. So I always kind of took the story as like, don't judge a book by its cover, which I don't think is a bad thing. I think that's definitely a great thing to think about as you read it. But then I started reading some more in-depth analysis of it and some more kind of faith-based analysis of it, which is like a whole nother conversation. But you know, when I read it, it was kind of like the point of this story is that to love, you have to be loved. Like the beast couldn't love until he was loved. And I know there's like the, you know, curse and all that stuff. And to me, that was just as an adult, like another rich layer, because I was like, how powerful is that when you think about it as an adult and you're thinking about marriage and family and children and you're looking at relationships in a much more bigger, deeper way. And so then it became like, I really do love this story because, you know, I think what it really shares is something far more deeper than we really think that it does. So that's kind of like, I've had multi-layers of it, I think. So it just became one of those things. Like to me, I'm always like, yeah, that's my favorite. Sorry. It's my favorite.
So as far as your children go, what are some of their favorites, if you don't mind sharing?
So, so the boys kind of like the more, if you're not surprised, the more like the Hansel and Gretel, like the more adventurous. They love Tom Thumb. I mean, that one, like they just love it. And I think it's a great one for like any kid. And then my daughter, of course, so she went in through a phase where we watched like a lot of those Disney, like the Snow White, the original cartoon. I mean, she loves those, the Cinderella, the Beauty and the Beast. She's a little bit older now, but the Hansel and Gretel at the time when she was younger, when I read it to her, was like, no, not her speed quite yet. But I mean, she loves the Cinderella book. She even has little golden book versions, you know, simple, quick versions, but she loves those. And I don't think it's a bad thing to share stories about girls being virtuous as she grows up. You know, I'm like, definitely. Even if it's kind of superficial in some ways, but I don't think that it necessarily is, you know, I think it's good to have the discussion of like, she kept her character. She, you know, did the right thing.
Absolutely.
And then she just enjoys it. Like she's just been I think she's been every princess character for Halloween. She's almost 8. So we've had Beauty and the Beast. We've had the Sleeping Beauty. And there's just something fun about that too. You know?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I think of the little princess, all girls are princesses. My little girl is the same. She's going through the Disney phase right now. But I mean, we read the fairy tales, we watch the movies. I'm kind of dreading having to read the real Little Mermaid to her because I don't think that's going to go over to
her. I'm not.
But the funny thing is, that's how I was introduced to it. I was in second grade at a friend's sleepover and they had like this 80s film version. It was very short of the real Little Mermaid, Hans Christian Andersen's version. Yeah. So when I saw the Disney one, it was much later and I was thought, wow, that's, it has a happy ending.
That's not right.
That's great. But yeah, I have a friend. It was the opposite. She read it after seeing the movie and was just devastated. But also a little fun fact, I have never watched the whole Disney version of Snow White. And there is a reason. And I feel so horrible about it. I, as a child, could not handle her voice. It was too
I can see that
for me. See My that. Daughter loves it. And she's watched it multiple times. And I still
My daughter loves it too. I don't think I watched it that much as a kid. Like, I don't remember that one being as, I mean, of course, again, like we were, I guess, what do you call it? A golden age. We had the Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, a 1001 Arabian Nights. I mean, there were lots of good things. So I don't remember watching that as much, but I can see that for sure.
Yeah.
It has an eerie feel to it too. I don't know why.
Yes.
It's not one of my faves, I'll be honest. Like, I like it as a historical document, kind of.
Yeah.
But I get you.
Yeah. I am the same way. So, Brittany, I had sent you this question about C.S. Lewis's essay, Sometimes Fairy Stories May Say Best What's to Be Said. And in it, he writes about falling in love with the form of fairy tales as he was writing The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, which I did not know about this. And he gives several reasons for his love of the form. And I'll share a short quote because he perfectly encapsulates some of the trademark elements of a fairy tale. He says, "Its brevity, its severe restraints on description, its flexible traditionalism, its inflexible hostility to all analysis, digression, reflections, and gas. I was now enamored of it. Its very limitations of vocabulary became an attraction." So I just wanted to discuss a couple of these trademarks of the form, and especially the short length of fairy tales. You mentioned earlier in our conversation about their brevity, and I'd like to talk about that in their sparse language. I just am so amazed about how much we get from these stories in just the very minimal and bare language. And also descriptions, just minimal descriptions. So why do you think these elements of fairy tales appeal to us?
So that's a great quote too. Not one that I don't know I've ever highlighted, but now I want to go back and really think upon that one when you sent it to me. So I think the brevity and the sparse language, one, I would lean back into kind of their oral origins. You almost can think about fairy tales in a sense like Shakespeare, like, you know, a lot of these were meant to be told and acted out in a sense. So like, you know, the repetition in Little Red Riding Hood, "What great big eyes you have," you know, that's a performative back and forth, if you will. So I think that's one kind of logistic moment of these two. And I think, you know, I'm not a historical publication person, but again, as you're publishing, it wasn't like Charles Perrault and Brothers Grimm, you know, were in the Amazon publishing age where you could just publish whatever you wanted and however much you wanted. So I think brevity had kind of, again, more of a like an almost logistic element to it. But then two, I think like the sparse language, why does that appeal to us? I think it gives our imaginations room. We get to illustrate it. You know, we get to think about, there are key details that are great, like the little glass slipper or the red cap. That's, you know, Brothers Grimm version, or the red cape in the Little Red Riding Hood. They aren't so overly detailed, but they're enough for us to build and illustrate on our own. So I think they pack a punch in a sense. I think that's one of the reasons why in my opinion, that they tend to connect with many, many audiences and have done for so long now is because you get the room to build in your own imaginative illustration of it. You can, you know, kind of mold it and think about it in the way you want. So I think they pack a punch in that way. And it's funny because students will often sign up for the class thinking like, they're short. Like, I don't have to read a lot. Ha ha ha. I beat the system. And one, you know, I tell them, especially in the beginning of the semester, I'm like, well, these are short for sure, but the discussion we have won't be short. And it is so funny after a few weeks. There are some weeks where we spend three class periods talking about Cinderella. And based on the length and the brevity of the story, you wouldn't think you could, but it unpacks so much about morals and virtues and stepsisters. And so in that sense, we get these brief narratives, but they tell us so much. And that's what C.S. Lewis is saying. And of course, he says it better than anybody else could.
I know. Exactly.
It's always hard to follow up with one of his quotes because you're like, oh, he said it. Right. Yes. But I think that's why. I think it gives us room to imagine.
I love that. I love that so much. And what you were saying about spending so much time talking about these stories, it's after reading The Nightingale, and I read it about two times and listened to it about three times. And it was the more I read it, the more I listened to it, there's more I was getting from it. And even when I sat down to write, I intended to write about one thing. And then I was like, but there's this and there's this and there's this. And it's so hard to stop yourself and to be maybe 10 pages in length or less, to be able to have that much that you get from it is just amazing.
Absolutely.
You just have to be in awe of the ability of the storyteller to so entrance the reader and have so many layers within it that it keeps them coming back for more and exploring the story even further. So
I would
love to pick I would love to pick their brains. At the end of that essay, Lewis says, at all ages, if it is well used by the author and meets the right reader, it has the same power to generalize while remaining concrete, to present in palpable form, not concepts or even experiences, but whole classes of experience, and to throw off irrelevancies. But at its best, it can do more. It can give us experiences we have never had, and thus, instead of commenting on life, can add to it. So I wanted to ask you, Brittany, in which ways do you or have you seen fairy tales add to the reader's life? And I'm curious, too, about your students, if they have had any moments while they're reading the stories.
So this is such a good question. And, you know, it's one that like we do wrestle with all semester is like, well, how have they lasted so long? Because certain things don't last across history, but like stories do. Myths, biblical stories, fairy tales. That's kind of our, you know, main, of course, there's other things involved, but like that's our main treasure trove of historical stories. And so it's definitely one of those things where you think you know the answer and then you wrestle with it for a while and you're like, right. I don't have an answer for it. But a couple of the layers that I see keeping them lasting is their ability to pack a punch, what we just talked about, their ability for the audience, the reader, in most cases, to come back again and see something new or hear something new in many cases. I mean, there is a reason why young girls particularly rewatch Cinderella or Snow White or Beauty and the Beast over and over again. A good story will bring them back and exactly. Or they want to hear it over and over again, right? I mean, kids do that. They repeat the story. Like I know we had those board books where kids were just like over and over and over again. But I would say it's also like this concept too of kind of the good versus the bad and this overcoming of that. Not every fairy tale does that. I mean, we talked about Hans Christian Andersen, and we talked about there's certain variations of Cinderella or Little Red Riding Hood where like the wolf does eat the little, you know, I mean, not all endings are perfect in fairy tales. And I think you do have a question about that later on, but and I'll pull up this quote from G.K. Chesterton. You probably have heard or come across this one before, but it's the one where he says, yeah, fairy tales do not tell children the dragons exist. Children already know the dragons exist. Fairy tales tell children the dragons can be killed. And that's one that I love sharing. It's one of my favorites. And I'm sure it is. Yeah. I mean, to me, that encompasses why these stories resonate not just with children and not just with adults, because we all know that these kinds of people or immoral situations exist. The question is, how do we overcome them or defeat them or beat them in a sense? In my mind, that's why these stories are in a sense timeless, because they're sharing that battle that, as far as I know, hasn't gone away and probably won't go away. You know? And for my students too, what's funny is once you unpack the layers of when you talk about, for example, Beauty and the Beast, and like, you know, why would you, how do you connect with someone and how do you marry someone if you're in a situation that is, in the case of Beauty and the Beast, is not, I guess, ideal. And once they start to see the relevance to their lives in the current year, it really starts to blossom for them. You know, like they all kind of come in, they're like, yeah, Cinderella. But then we start to talk about like, how do you deal? Like if Cinderella was dealing with these stepsisters, and who's ever dealt with maybe a step parent who's not so great. And then they start to look and they start to think, maybe it is kind of relevant, you know? And even, and this is one of the things I've talked about, like in my community, is like, and forgive me, because I cannot think of who I got this info from, but there's a famous kind of newspaper article. I want to say it was in a big city in the 90s, but it was like, how many Hansel and Gretels are running around our city? It's a story, but it's also kind of a true story. Like parents who maybe don't make great choices for their kids and in fact make bad ones, you know? So I think the relevance of it on the surface doesn't seem obvious, but once you unpack it, you start to think, this is interesting. This is relevant. This story actually means something. And now I can connect with it. And now I can unpack it. And now I can kind of illustrate it in my imagination. So I think they're important, I guess, at the end of the day, you know?
Oh, I love that. I love that answer, Brittany. When you were talking and you mentioned the good versus evil and how fairy tales kind of bolster that up in us and inform the child's imagination in that way, their moral imagination. I was thinking of one of the things that is like bugs me the most about some modern children's literature is they will have so much of the gray area when it comes to a bad guy, and they won't have evil be evil and good be good, which I can understand that for an older child, an adult who's had that moral imagination formed. But for a child, that can be so confusing because they don't have that understanding yet. And I know there was so much controversy when Harry Potter first came out, but one of the things I loved about Harry Potter is it has good and evil portrayed in it. And it's such a clear line. And I just appreciate that J.K. Rowling did that for children, because I feel like that's kind of missing now.
Well, and I also think, I mean, Harry Potter's been around longer than I actually realize now.
Yeah, but, I know. At the time, there was controversy when it first came out.
Right. But like, why has that book been so popular? It's a great conversation piece in my class, because a lot of times my students like grew up with it, right? Like they were young and they started it or whatever. And, you know, I tell them there's got to be a reason why this book or series hooked so many people. And I think she's a great writer. I think there's multiple like literary things you could talk about with that. But I'm like, at the end of the day, you said it so well. I think it's just a clear line between good and evil. And that is what people are looking for in a story. In fact, my middle child, he is 9 and he is in his Harry Potter reading phase. Like he is like, he is just in it, you know, and I love watching it. And he is the kind of kid who loves those stories. Like he loves those kinds of stories. So I think Harry Potter is another perfect, to me, example of like, well, why has this story been so popular? You know, it's not the book cover. I know her descriptions of food are great, and I'm here for that.
Oh, I know. I love that.
And that is such a great thing. But I think deep down, it's exactly what you said. It's it's a story of good versus evil.
Yeah, I love that about it so much. Some modern critiques of fairy tales are that they give children the false ideal of the happy ever after ending. I know that was a lot of flack that I was hearing about as I guess I got into the teen years, and especially as it pertains to romantic love. I'm thinking of Cinderella. I am personally of the Tolkien persuasion that the fairy tale is eucatastrophic, that the happily ever after ending is a beautiful depiction of redemption. And as Tolkien says, a sudden and miraculous grace. What are your thoughts on this?
So I think this is a fantastic question too. In fact, it's one of those I was like, oh, this would be great for a class. So, So we definitely talk about Tolkien. So the way that I kind of like to refute this kind of quote unquote happily ever after ending, because that is I think it is kind of almost a modern interpretation of fairy tales. And I do blame / give credit to Disney for that, because all those movies we've mentioned, there is a nice tidy little bow at the end. And as you mentioned about like a modern children's publication, what drives me crazy is like the endings are one, maybe not accurate, or two, like just so tidy and perfect, right? Everyone's perfect and the ending's perfect. And so one of the ways that I like to describe it, so Marina Warner is also one of my favorite fairy tale critics. She has, and if you remind me, I think I wrote down her one of her book titles, but it's just Once Upon a Time. But she's done a ton of work carefully parsing fairy tales. And if you could, you can even, you know, just find her some interviews on YouTube. She's actually a dame. So you have to type in Dame Marina Warner. Yes, I know. Fancy, right? So one of the characteristics, she has a great list, kind of a nice framework for fairy tales. And one of the ways she expresses it is, or says, is fairy tales, the endings express hope. It's an expression of hope. And so I've always kind of used that because I feel like that's a really great way to describe that. In some cases, the ending works out well. In some cases, it doesn't. But the ones that we think about, there is this thread of hope in it. And that, to me, fits in exactly, like, that's what Tolkien's saying, like this concept of redemption. Now, not all fairy tales end with redemption, or not grimly, you know, some end not great and some end without redemption. I can think of a few, but he kind of encapsulates, I guess, again, one of the reasons I like these stories is because this sense of grace, the sense of redemption, and especially as a parent now, you know, maybe not something I was looking for, you know, when I was, but now that as a parent, this is something I want to share. And I think these stories do that really well. One of my favorite examples is in one of the Charles Perrault's Cinderella versions. She helps the stepsisters, like she forgives them and she helps them find husbands, you know, and that's one thing when you bring it up in class, you know, my students are like, I would never do that. You know, I would not.
Right.
You know, but I'm like, let's stop and think, like, let's stop and pause about that kind of redemption and what it takes to do that and what you're really like learning from that story. And so I think that this concept of redemption to me has probably become, as I've gotten older, one of the more important elements of the stories, but also kind of like everything we've been saying, I think it's one of the reasons these stories keep moving along. They give us a sense of grace, a sense of hope, a sense of redemption. Maybe not perfect, but there's a hint of it. And that's what we need. We need a hint of something.
It keeps us going. And I think when I was younger, it was the romantic part of it that
just was
like, it draws you to it. And now as I'm older, it's like, that's on the periphery. I am so much more enthralled with the stories of redemption. And you mentioned Cinderella and her kindness. I love that, especially with my little girl. I want to instill that in her of being kind and how that is a good thing. I love the Kenneth Branagh Cinderella
with
Lily James. And
it's one of my favorites. I love that one.
I love that one so much. She's so kind.
And she, as an actress, she's one of my favorites, but like somehow she gets that role so well. And I'm not a huge like film critic or anything like that. I can't put my finger on it, but like how she does it just to me, like encapsulates what in my head I've been thinking, you know?
Exactly.
Absolutely. It's one of my favorites. Yeah.
She knows who she is. There is that strength of character that she's comfortable in her own skin. She does not think of herself as what her stepmother is saying to her. She has her moments where she gets down, but she knows her worth and she knows her value. I think of that as like a Christian, how we know our worth and our value in Christ.
Absolutely.
So it's not like she's not looking for it in other ways. And so I love that. Again, that portrayal, as you said, it's phenomenal.
Right. I totally agree.
And one funny story is with Little Mermaid and how we were talking about the happy endings and some people feel like it's an effect on young girls. So my daughter was 4 at the time. So this was last year and we were watching Little Mermaid and she'd seen it before, but we get to the end and she was asking, well, why isn't why isn't she a mermaid anymore? And I was like, well, she chose to get married and her daddy turned her into like a human. And then, so we're going through all these things. And she's like, but then she's not going to be with her daddy. And I was like, well, yeah, but she has the prince. And she goes, what about her friends? And I was like, well, she gave that all up so she could be with the prince. And this is what she says. She goes, well, I hope he's worth it. And that was the end for her. And I was like, I didn't even coach her.
That's
anything,
great. But that's, it was so just great. Yeah, he funny. Better be yeah. worth it.
I know. But I think again, it's like, that's, we don't give great. Them the credit of like, we have that.
No, we
fear.
Don't. We really
we
don't.
Have fear. They're going to grow up and they're going to think it's just going to be love at first sight. But here's a 4-year-old saying, but she had, this is what she had to give up for that. That doesn't make sense to me.
Right.
Yeah.
He better be worth it. I love that. That's great. That's
She's
great.
A character. Brittany, we both share. Oh, wait, before I get to this question, I have a couple others that I'm going to just throw at you, and I'm sorry. But I would love to know, when we talked earlier about your children's favorite stories, did I ask you? I don't think I did. I was thinking it. But what are some of your students' favorite stories?
So a lot of them are not super familiar. You're talking about fairy tales, right?
Right.
They're familiar with the cartoon version or the animated version. And then there are a lot of like 90s movie Cinderella spinoffs. So they're kind of familiar with those. But what they end up usually liking are Beauty and the Beast, Cinderella. They all really lean into Little Red Riding Hood. They end up really digging into that, especially based on the like maybe the little version that they came in knowing. They like Hans Christian Andersen. I'm trying to think what else. What's funny is, well, I'll say this. So in the class, we do have to read novels, unfortunately for them. Okay. Again, not, they didn't really realize that. So there's been a few semesters where we've had a few novels, and I'll explain in a minute, in a second, because we do usually read Charlie and the Chocolate Factory too.
I want to know what these novels are, because I'm going to put them down.
Yeah, Briar Rose is a good one. I'll give you that title. Briar Rose is Jane Yolen. So Jane Yolen wrote a lot of kind of, I guess, what, chapter books. This one's a more current-ish one, but it is a Sleeping Beauty book, but it's intertwined with the Holocaust. It's a fascinating story. It's about, and this is based off a true story, a castle in, it might have been Austria, but it could have been Germany too. I can't remember now off the top of my head. A castle was used as a concentration camp. Like it, in World War II, the Nazis used an old castle. And I can't think of the city off the top of my head, but we do a little research with it. So Jane Yolen found out about it, and she had done a ton of work with fairy tales. She'd written these great books and combined it into this book called Briar Rose, which Briar Rose is another title of Sleeping Beauty version where she gets stuck behind. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the briars have a lot of, you know, like the briar fencing or the barbed wires and the briars. It's like, there's a lot to it. So anyway, she does this like kind of, what do you want to call it? Like kind of back in time story of a grandmother kind of living that experience. And she ties in Sleeping Beauty to it. And it is a great book. I would definitely not recommend it for younger audiences. Definitely listed as like a young adult book. And we all had to like, you know, take a breath with it. But what's funny is maybe like halfway through the semester, we were moving on to some projects and stuff. And the students were like, you know, we really just like to continue reading these fairy tales. Like we really like them. And I was like, okay, cool. Like let's bring some in when we can, you know?
Dad.
So it is something that always surprises me how they resonate with it once you introduce it to them and unpack it. And it's the same with kids too, right? Like you said, we don't give them enough credit. If you introduce it to them, it will resonate with them. Right. May not every story for every kid. And some kids may not like the violent ones. And I don't, you know, there are a few that, you know, I have stepped back from, but I think it's the same, you know, once they get it, they like them.
When you were talking about Sleeping Beauty, I was thinking of the Disney version, and you mentioned Briar Rose, and it just like something just clicked. I'm sorry, I'm going off topic a little bit, but I love that version because in the end, the Prince Philip has the sword of truth and the shield of virtue to defeat the dragon. And I love that so much. I love that they had that in the movie. And it's funny because when I was growing up, I loved Sleeping Beauty. That's one of my favorites. And my mom wouldn't let us watch it because she was afraid. I was a very sensitive child. And I think she was afraid it was going to scare me too much. But I loved that one. And I always wanted to watch it. And when my husband and I were dating, I found out through Facebook that that was one of his favorite movies as well, because he loves the Technicolor. He's a very much like a visual person.
It's cool,
like,
though. It is cool.
Yeah,
movie.
It's like the colors are wonderful. So back on track, are there any other novels that you do in the class that have that fairy tale
background? So that one has been, let me think. We do Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. We did, it's like the Sisters Grimm is
chapter
series. And so I let students kind of go off and kind of do their own projects, but that's been a really popular one. Yeah. And I don't know if I'd quite, it's been a while since I've looked at those, but I don't know if I'd quite recommend them for super young audience, but that's one that my students have really leaned into. They really like that.
Yeah. So are there any stories that the students have a very strong reaction to that they don't like, that they don't really come around? And are there any that you personally just don't, you can appreciate them for, like you said, their historical context, but are just that's just not one for me?
I struggle with Hans Christian Andersen's Little Mermaid because I get it and I want to.
Yeah.
But at the same time, his stories do that. Like they kind of get you in the heart right away and Little Match Girl. So
I was thinking that one. That was what I was thinking of.
Which at the same time, I get it. I like it. Is it my favorite? But it makes me think, I have this quandary with those, and my students feel the same way. So we read some of these different variations. So there are a couple different versions of Snow White, and there are a couple of versions. So I haven't even gotten to the Italian fairy tales, but there's Basile and Straparola. And again, butchering names here, but these are two names. So if you're looking for different versions, those are the kind of the Italian versions. And of course, not to be culturally generalized, but the Italian ones are kind of bizarre. They're definitely passionate. So be forewarned.
Okay.
They do not, hesitate. And it's all innuendo. It's not really even anything.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's definitely, and there's some really strange ones. There's ones where cannibalism, chopping up of a sister and eating her in a stew. So my students are not that they don't, they have a strong reaction. Some people are they think the stories are great because they're so bombastic. But we definitely there's strong reaction to these moments. It's more not necessarily stories. It's more moments of stuff like that, like the cannibalism, which you find in quite a few stories, incest, they always get, they just have a strong reaction to these types of things and really well, why is that? And I'm like, well, one, it's kind of a way to say in these particular stories, this isn't socially acceptable. It's not morally acceptable. You know, incest isn't, they're not saying that, but they're saying it through story,
They're not condoning it. You get that, as you should, you get that reaction of this isn't right. Something is wrong.
Exactly. It's not as much necessary, I would say, stories. There's some that you have to spend a lot of time on, but I think it's definitely more the reaction value to the way certain things are discussed or the shock value of certain things that they're not used to is what it is.
Okay. There's one, I don't remember what it's called. And I don't even think my friend could remember what it was, but she said that there was one where it's I think a girl's brothers kill the man she loves and she carries his head around in a pot. There's she gets revenge on them somehow. Do you know what?
I think I know what you're talking about, but I'm also thinking of Bluebeard. So Bluebeard is one again. Well, that one, I guess they're always strong reactions to it. It's that again, that they like it or don't like it. They're always just what? I'm and I was trying to prepare them, for certain particular stories. I'm like, guys, this one's going to be, prepare yourself. So some of, when we talk about expression of hope, and then I think about stories like that. I mean, there are some gruesome fairy tales out there. And I think you kind of have to lean into it was entertainment too. It was entertainment. Not that we accept that, not that we think it's appropriate, but it was entertainment.
Exactly. And some were used as cautionary tales because I'm thinking of some of, I think it's the German stories for children that they, I can't remember the one where it's the, some very bad ending for children because they didn't obey or things like that.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah. I know what you're talking. Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. It's just like really horrific. And I'm like, I prefer a different way of teaching my child than scaring them that much.
Yeah, that seems pretty harsh there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Brittany, I'm also curious of other countries. So perhaps not just European countries, but other, I love the Russian fairy tales as well. I know I've been corresponding with someone who's reading The Arabian Nights. And she said she wasn't quite prepared for the content in that because I guess she had read and I had been exposed to more of the children's stories in that, a little bit more sanitized. But I'm curious to know if you have any fairy tales from other countries that we haven't discussed that you especially love.
So the Italian fairy tales are kind of passionate. We talked about those. You can definitely, and the cool thing about it is, I'll have to send you a link because I have one and it's an old website. But what's nice about it is you can literally just kind of go through a map and you can click on a country and you can find fairy tales. And what's fascinating, so I usually talk about Cinderella with this one because this is an easy one. But Cinderella is our oldest and most popular fairy tale. And we can kind of accurately say that. I mean, the types of versions of fairy tales of Cinderella that we know of range from about 500 to like 2000. Like we just know that many, many cultures had this type of tale, right? If they didn't always have a glass slipper, it wasn't exact in terms of plot, but we had this kind of moral virtuous heroine who was dealing with a family situation, potentially finding a prince or a marriage or a better outcome. And that's pretty cool. Like if you start to go back and look through, you know, what culture had their, what was their version of Cinderella like? So one that I like to talk about is Ye Shen. Probably not pronouncing that properly, but it's the Chinese version of Cinderella.
Ooh.
And it's extremely old. And if you, I can send you a link to it, but if you look it up, it was published in, it's a very, very old tale. And of course, there have been many illustrated picture book publications of it. There's one that is, seems to be more popular. And I remember it as a kid and it's still available. It's like the front cover has like a green dragon on it. And it's a picture book. I read it as a kid. I still have a copy of it. And it is, you know, for example, instead of little glass slipper, there are like fish bones, like the magic fairy godmother is magic fish bones. And, you know, the article of clothing isn't a glass slipper. It's just like a cloak, but it still has to do with the stepmother and stepsisters. And so that is one of the oldest, I guess, Cinderella variations that we have. And it's, I mean, you can still find the publication to it. And so what I find so fascinating is that you can look across the globe and kind of pinpoint, maybe not a country necessarily, but like a region.
Yeah.
And you can find the Hispanic variation, the Brazilian version of Cinderella, right? Or the variation that they had. So one of the things that I think is kind of cool is to kind of find a story that you like and then kind of work your way out that way.
Oh, how
like
fun.
Say, yeah, you know, African fairy tales. I mean, there once you start, you're like, this is, there's so much here. But I think Cinderella, if people are looking for a story that they can find across cultures,
yeah,
it's been around for a long time. I would start with Cinderella. I would look at Ye Shen. I would look at maybe some African versions, and then you'll be able to see this story is its consistency across different places.
Oh, that's so exciting. Oh, okay. Thank you. I'm looking forward to that link. I can't wait to explore those stories.
Yeah. It's really cool.
Yeah. Brittany, we both share a love of Roald Dahl's books, especially Boy. You told me that's also one of your favorites. You mentioned that you often link Charlie and the Chocolate Factory to child-led fairy tales. Can you please share more about this? You also talked about it being in your class, so I would love to hear what you have to say about Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
So I think you're reading it out loud now, right? You said
yes
with your daughter. Mm-hmm. So I think it's one, I think it's just a great book. My kids love it. We've read it out loud. So one of the things I love to discuss is like, is Roald Dahl like a kind of a modern fairy tale author? And that's an open-ended question because I think there's multiple responses to it. But one of the things we try to explore in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory is what his kind of, I guess, adventures are and what kind of obstacles is he up against and how does he kind of work his way through them? And so some of the things that we talk about that may have a connection to fairy tales have to do, especially with his family in the beginning, and the poverty and the lack of food. Yes. And so lack of food is a huge theme mm-hmm. in fairy tales, simply because it was just a matter of life, matter of fact. Yeah. And so we talk a lot about that, you know, that kind of connection, if you see it as one, which I kind of do. He's not an orphan, but he's struggling with a lot. His parents are supportive, but, you know, they're still mm-hmm. figuring out how to live day to day, I guess, if you will. He goes into this kind of fantasy world. There's definitely an element of fantasy and magic, mm-hmm. right? And so, you know, does he have like a fairy godmother? Is Wonka his fairy godmother, godfather, I guess?
Yeah.
And so it's not that these are, I don't know, that's the question I said a while ago, like that's what you wrestle with, is are these like new adapted versions of fairy tales, or are they just based in them? I do think Roald Dahl, like if you read his book, The Witches, have you read that?
Yes, I love The Witches.
Yes, I think like yeah. when you read that and then you read some of the fairy tale, like stepmother villain, for sure, he was, I feel very confident that Roald Dahl was like sitting in his like, you know, study doing that. Yeah. So I think, and then you get the candy. So a lot of my students and I like to make this connection to get the Hansel and Gretel, the witch's house, and this concept that we have that like, you know, it's made of sugar. And is that like, is there a connection here with this like candy built place that's kind of entrancing him in?
Yeah.
So I think you can kind of play around with it.
Yeah.
And even if it's not a direct connection, I think that there are certainly influences there, at least the way that I kind of look at it. And even then, I just think it's a great book. It's one of my favorites.
I do too. And I love that you made that connection. I would have to say that when I read Charlie and the Chocolate Factory now, he kind of reminds me slightly of Mary Poppins in this way. You don't know if he's like this good character, not like a, like not an evil character, but is he slightly menacing? You know how you get, I feel like that. Oh, when
yeah,
I read
absolutely
Mary Poppins.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah
So it's funny, so we have gone to see the new movie Wonka, which has his backstory, and this is what started my daughter wanting to read Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, because she loved the movie so much. We all loved the movie. We just got a copy today and we watched it and had like, we had our hot chocolate and our candy. But I just love that whole world that is created, and it's even being able to, you know, a new generation of children are being reached by this newer movie. But again, like you said, it's just, it's such a good story. I'm like reading it aloud, I'm like, he read this aloud as he wrote this. He knows how it works so well as a read aloud. This is perfect for parents to read to their children.
Well, Roald Dahl's funny because he was interviewed, and he's got a lot of interesting, you know, interviews and things like that.
Oh, yes,
but he
I'm
is
sure.
quoted as saying, it's like, children are the best editors. He was like, and he's got this whole like discussion, and I'll paraphrase, but essentially like, he's like, I'll ask, you know, kids, like, is this funny? Is it good? And if they yeah. don't like it, then it's not going in the book. Like, he legitimately used his own kids and other kids to say, like, if they're not into it, it's not working. So like, as you were saying, like, you can tell that he did that. Like my kids, so we love Matilda too. Like, there are just parts of that book that, like, you know, they just couldn't quit thinking about.
Oh, I haven't read Matilda yet, but I have.
Oh,
on my
put
list.
It on your, yeah, you will get there soon, I'm yeah. sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do love also, again, it's that brevity. He has yeah. very short chapters. My daughter, yes. like, seriously, the first day we started reading it, she's five. She's a new five. And we read 10 chapters before she said she was ready to stop, which to me, I'm like, that's amazing.
Right. I think that's, it keeps the attention, which I agree with you. We've stopped and started a lot of chapter books out loud, and mm-hmm. some, they just go on too long. Some they're not, but like, I've never had that problem with Roald Dahl ever.
No.
Like, yeah. They just stick with it and love it. Yeah.
Yeah. We'll have to have a whole conversation about him. I know that we had toyed with that idea, but we have to do it, Brittany.
Yeah.
It has to be.
It has to happen for sure. Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to move on to the very end, and I thank you for all the time, because I know it's difficult as a mom to get away for as long as we've been able to chat. But I like to ask a quick round of literary questions at the end for fun. So the first one is, Brittany, what is the best book you've read in the last year?
Okay, so these questions are fun, but so hard for me. I feel like you're
everybody
asking me,
says this.
Like, I always feel like You're asking me my favorite child, but okay. So I think I'm a little bit late to the game on this, but A Place to Hang the Moon. Yes. So I only read it a couple months ago. I know it came out a bit before that. I can't remember, but I know I was a little bit late to it. Truly, truly. I mean, for someone who's read and has a used bookshelf of children's books, shelves, like overwhelming. It is one of the best I've read. I mean, I don't gush about books that I love very much because I just don't find them often. But this one, this one is great. Yeah, this one is great.
This is the one that I was telling all my friends. I would say you need to go ahead and spend the money, buy the copy. Don't wait. You just need to buy it. It's going to stay on your shelf. Yes.
For some reason, I got it from the library and I haven't bought it yet. And when I was like answering, I was like, I haven't bought it. It's truly it will stay on my bookshelf. Right. It is such a good book.
It's so good. It's the book. So I think I've said this on the podcast, but there's the Story Shop, the store that I love so much that's near us.
Oh, yes.
The children's bookstore. One of my dear friends from there is the one who suggested it to me. And I just am forever grateful to her for putting that book in my hand. It's just,
it's so good. It's so good.
It's so good.
If people haven't read it yet,
they
have
to.
Go get it.
They have to. Yeah. It's just, it is the best. If you were trapped on a desert island, what 5 books would you miss the most?
Okay. So this is another hard one, but a hard, but a good one. I'm going to take a wiggle room and say any of C.S. Lewis's books. Okay. So I'm going to be a wiggle room person on that. Cause I that any of them, Narnia, all that. So I was that's not really fair, but I'm just going to do it.
You can just have one volume of C.S. Lewis's complete works.
There you go. Matilda. It's one of my favorite books of all time. Yeah, it's for sure. I mean, ever since I read it the first time when I was little, probably, I don't know, whatever, in third grade or something, one of my favorites of all time. So I don't know if you've talked about this on your podcast, but Miss Piggle Wiggle. So that's one that
I have not, but I loved Miss Piggle Wiggle.
Yeah. So I grew up loving it, and my kids, that is one. And that's one too, when you were talking about at night, tonight, I just want to read one chapter, her chapters are little stories. So you can just kind of go through. So that one has kind of been reemerged for me. So Outlander, I love Outlander. I reread it every few years. I think it's a great book. One of my favorites. And it's something when people ask me, I'm like, it's true. I just do. And then I just
no shame.
No shame. And then I have to do, I know it's kind of cliche, and I know a lot of people say Pride and Prejudice. I just have to put it on there. Yes. I can't.
Oh, absolutely. And
I mean, this would be my shelves are overflowing, and I always say, should I get rid of books or not? But Desert Island, I would have a problem. I would have a problem.
Oh, I know.
I would have a problem.
Same here.
We'd leave behind the sunscreen or something important. I'm sure.
Exactly. Who needs that?
Who needs that? Probably not there.
Yeah. What is a book you haven't read but have always meant to read?
This was a great question. So I think, I'm going to say Charles Dickens, because I know that I dabbled in it in undergrad. I know that my kids have a few illustrated type versions of his stories. And of course, the Christmas story, the Christmas one is familiar. We reread that. We have a picture version of it, but I haven't really truly delved into it as an adult. So I started David Copperfield, but that's something that I'm is on my list of things that I want to kind of start to go through methodically, because I just don't talk about him that much. I haven't read him that much, but I feel like I'm missing out on some really great stories.
Yeah.
So that's something to me is kind of a goal of mine this year is to kind of start to work through those.
I love that. I've read a few of his. I'm mixed on Dickens. I love some of his stuff. And some of his stuff I feel like is a little heavy handed.
Yeah.
Or it just needs to be a little shorter. But
Maybe that's why I have it.
Yeah, I love A Tale of Two Cities. That's one of my, like, I read it as a teenager and I'd like to read it again. But I was fascinated with the French Revolution. I think I just couldn't understand why this happened. And so I love that one. I've read Great Expectations, and we read Hard Times recently in a book club. And I kind of mixed on Hard Times. And I've also read Bleak House for an undergrad class, but that's, Bleak House is one of the ones I'm very mixed about it. There are really some really good parts, some good characters in it, but there's also Spontaneous Combustion, which is like a fun, fun little thing that happens in it.
We had to read some of Bleak House in undergrad, but like it obviously didn't stick with me. So kind of like what you're saying, like, and I know a lot of people feel that way, but that's definitely something I'm like, you know, I'd like to be able to say, these are my favorites or these are my not favorites.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
But I do think he's had a huge influence. But I agree with you that a lot of people have a lot of differing thoughts about him.
Yeah. But no, I definitely love A Tale of Two Cities. It's a shorter one.
I'll have to shift that one up for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. It's one. I have friends who didn't like it, but I loved it. If you could invite any author or literary character to dinner, who would it be? Let's say you can have 3 to 5 people or characters, and what would you serve?
Okay. So for some reason, when I read this, I thought authors, but then I was like, you know what? I'm just going to do an author one, because a character one would be a whole different thing, but it'd be a really fun thing too. And then I started going down the rabbit trail and I was like, okay, I'm just going to stick with this one. So my current dinner party, I love this question. In fact, I think I'm going to bring it into class. I love it too.
I love to hear people.
Yeah, I love this one. So this is a bit more broad, but for me at least, based off the discussion we've had tonight, but I would bring in Ernest Hemingway. Because he always brings in a party. And I do like, I don't like everything he wrote, but I do like a lot of his stories. I would bring Eudora Welty. So Eudora Welty was like a Southern female writer. Mm-hmm. And she's one of my favorites. And some of her short stories are just some of my favorites of all time. I just enjoy them. And I feel like she would be so interesting and charming at a party.
Yeah.
Roald Dahl. I feel like Roald Dahl would be a little bit like maybe not the most charismatic at a party, but I would just chew his ear off, you know?
Right.
I would have to bring Charles Perrault, because he lived in France around French aristocracy. And I feel like would just, you know, elevate that level and have to talk to him. And then we would have champagne, charcuterie, desserts, and music, because I think it would just be a fantastic party. I think it would turn into a great party. Asked me that question, I was like, okay. This is what I can envision.
I love that answer. I love the food choice. That sounds delightful. And Eudora Welty, she's from Mississippi, correct? So yes. I was born in Mississippi. My parents lived there.
Oh, cool.
I was there until I was about 3. So my parents went to school in Mississippi, and that's why, and they ended up staying there. So they had a good experience there.
Nice.
But I have read her, is it called A Writer's Beginning?
Yes.
Is that the one?
Yes. That's one of my favorites.
I remember there's parts of, and I read it decades ago, but there's parts of it that I still have stayed in my mind.
It is so good. And it's pretty short, but she's got such good, profound moments in it. And that's one of my favorites that I love. Yes. I have that one in my office.
I read, and I want to reread it, because I don't think at the time I really could grasp what was going on in the story. I think it was the time of my life. The Optimist's Daughter.
That's probably what she's most famous for, I'd say.
And I want to go back and read that again, but I have a bunch of her short stories, and I was even thinking, I'm like, oh, I haven't read these in forever. Maybe I'll just go take them to the used bookstore. But now that you said that, I'm not going to. I'm going to go ahead and read them.
So one of my recommendations would be just a short story, because that's what I like about short stories. You can just pick up something short, which is nice sometimes. Yeah. Is why I lived at the PO post office. It's one of my favorites. It makes me laugh. It's easy. It's fun. It's not fun, but there's lots of interesting elements to it, but it's quick. And I don't know. It makes me laugh every time I read it.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Okay. I can't wait. I'm so excited. This is going to be so fun. I have more and more books to read now. I'm excited. Finally, Brittany, before we close up, do you have any book recommendations that you want to share? Any other book recommendations?
So, okay. So I'm going to start with what we talked about. And then, okay. So there's a lot of illustrated fairy tales version. In fact, you and I were emailing because you were talking about the one. I would say one of mine that I love, it's, I can send you the specific edition, but Maria Tatar, the one I mentioned, who has this great hardback illustrated version. And what's so fantastic about it is you get little snippets of history in it. And then you also get like info about some of the illustrations. So it's almost like a annotated copy, I guess, but it's beautiful. So I will send you that. It's actually in my office, but I will send you the specific edition. It's one that I love and one that my kids love. And even like my students love to look at, like it's nice to look at. So I always recommend that one. If you're like trying to figure out one, like you want to get the real tales and you want to start somewhere. That's one of my favorites. I'll keep that forever. Tending the Heart of Virtue, which I think you've discussed recently, but that is a great one. It's newer to me, but I think again, if you just like to talk about literature, or even like teach it to your kids, I think it's so fantastic. It's enjoyable to read too.
Yeah, and I'm still reading it, and this is the first time I've read it, so I'm new to it as well. But I'm really enjoying it.
I would say, and I really love that it's like it's something that people are picking up, because I think it's such a good explanation. You can just tell he knew how to teach people about stuff. So I just love that. Roald Dahl books. So I'd say like if people are looking into that, James and the Giant Peach is a fun read aloud too. So if your kids maybe are on the youngerish side, I would say that's a fun one. Yeah. I would say The Witches, if your kids are a bit older and okay with like some creepy stuff. But speaking of fairy tale influence in that one, like Roald Dahl's grandmother was Norwegian. So he spent summers in Norway, like kind of isolated Norway with his mom and his siblings. Well, you know that from Boy.
Right.
In The Witches, the grandmother, who's one of the main characters, is Norwegian. And so I always thought that was pretty fun.
So Brittany, that's one of my favorite parts of the book. I love
Me too. I love that grandmother. She's so great.
Her storytelling. I love the storyteller in it. There's just something so comforting and homey and cozy about that. So
When we were talking earlier, you were like, what books did your students like? Well, after we read Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, I talked about The Witches and I was like, I didn't make the syllabus this time. I wasn't sure. You know, I try to keep a variety of authors, and they were like, why didn't you assign The Witches? That sounds awesome. So I would definitely say, especially those older kids, like if people haven't done that, those particular ones, Roald Dahl, I mean, I think you can pick up any of his books, but obviously I'm a little bit biased. I've got two other random kind of chapter books, but The Westing Game.
I have not read it. I have a copy, but I have not
read it. It's just one of my favorites. I grew up on it. I've read it to my kids. It's like a mystery, but it's not gory or graphic. It is very, what's a good word to describe? It's like a puzzling mystery. Like it's kind of hard to figure out, I guess is what I'm trying to say. Ooh. But it's geared for like upper middle grade ages.
Okay.
I just really like it. I think that if you, and I mean, I read it as an adult, so I don't really distinguish like kid at all. I'm like, I read them all.
No,
so
I don't either.
That to me, that's not really an issue. But I think if you're into like kind of like mysteries and ones that are like kind of tricky, I guess, to figure out, it's one of my favorite all time books. I wouldn't even say it was like a Caldecott winner at the time. It came out in the late 80s or 90s.
Yeah.
And then lastly, Goodnight, Mr. Tom. So Goodnight, Mr. Tom, have you read it?
No, I haven't. There was a BBC production of it.
Yes.
Oh, goodness, decades ago. And I watched
a long time ago. So this is another like 80s book, but it's one that for me, like I even remember as a kid, like writing book reports on it. I was like, this is my favorite book. And it is so like A Place to Hang the Moon. We talked about being just a fantastic book, but this book is kind of it's a similar plot line. So it's a young boy who's sent out to the countryside during World War II Blitz in London. Except for he's coming from a really bad home life, but it's just him. And then he gets paired with, or I guess put into a home where it's just an older man who's widowed and very cranky and he's not a friendly guy. He's not a charismatic guy. And he's not super thrilled about having like a young kid with issues, especially coming from London in his house. And they kind of form this relationship that by the end of the book, you are like, it's just so good. Like, just the experience of them living in the countryside and kind of him living through World War II and becoming a part of the community. And it is just one of my favorites of all time. It is such a good book. Yeah.
Oh, I can't wait. Okay. I'm going to put that.
Yeah. That's a great book. Yeah. And I would say too, for people, like, it's not, you know, some books like that during World War II, like the bombing and mm-hmm. it's not super graphic. I mean, it's real, but it's not like something I think that would be super scary by any means.
Okay.
Yeah. For kids, you know, I think it treats the situation kind of like, you know, they're out in the countryside. So they're kind of separated, yeah. if you will, from a lot of like more violent, scary type situations.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, I'm so excited about that one. Yeah. I can't wait.
So those are all that I have right now when I say that, because again, like, I just have like, I don't know. So many genres, you know, if you're like, what about this genre? I'd be like, ooh, yeah. I love that. You know? So these are kind of the top ones that one I love, or two, just like, I think are just great for like parents or people who just love to read. So that's where that list comes from.
Okay. Well, I need to have you on again so we can talk about Roald Dahl and also children's literature.
Because sure.
I share that love of children's literature as well. And I love
that. Well, that's one of the reasons I love your podcast, because, you know, I love just hearing about like books that I didn't remember or books that I'm like haven't discovered yet. You know, that's just what I like to do.
So. I know. These are just the books that I think of in You've Got Mail, when she's talking about the books that stay with a child and kind of form them. Oh, yeah. I love that. And I think of that so often. That's me with stories, how those very special stories at just the right time in my life, introduced by, you know, teachers or mentors or my mom, and just how much they have meant. And so, of course, I want to share that with other people. I want other children to delight in those stories as well. So,
absolutely. I totally agree.
Yeah. So we will talk again, Brittany. And I thank you
absolutely.
So much for this time. This has been such a delight. I have enjoyed
this
so
you.
Much.
I've enjoyed it so much.
I know. I told you.
I was like, this could go on forever. Like,
I know.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to get off this and I'm going to think of a million more questions.
I know. I was already thinking like, I need to send her that and send her that.
Yeah.
And send her
oh,
that.
Please do.
So, yeah,
please do.
Absolutely.
I'm going down the rabbit hole and I'm loving it.
Good. Go for it. I say run with it.
Yes. Well, thank you again, Brittany.
Thank you so much. And we'll talk soon for sure. Yes. Thank you.
Well, that's all for today. I'll be back in 2 weeks with a new episode. If you'd like to connect in the meantime, you can email me at beth@awellreadlife.com. I would love to hear from you. I've had a few of you email me and I just have so much fun with those conversations. You can also find me on Instagram at Well Read Beth. I've said many times, I don't post on there very much, but I do check my DMs. And again, a disclaimer, if I'm ever late in responding, it is not because I won't. It is only because I am a mom to a very lovely and lively 5-year-old and am often very exhausted at the end of the day because we have had a full day of tea and stories and many shenanigans. But please do, if you have any book suggestions or you just want to have a bookish conversation, please do send me a message on one of those two platforms. We are just having the beginnings of spring here in Georgia, and it's promising to be a very mild April coming up, which I am very thrilled about because I never look forward to the heat of summer here. I hope wherever you are that you are enjoying this beautiful world around you. And I hope that you are enjoying a good book. Happy reading. Until next time.